96.3 FM, Southside St. Pete's own community radio station, WBPU, Black People United.
It's lit!
Gentlemen, boys and girls, this is your captain speaking. We've just landed at the world-famous Morris Bishop International Airport. Welcome to Grenada, the beautiful Isle of Spice.
Thank you.
Uhuru, you are listening to Diasporic Music on Black Power 96 with Norman Otis Richmond, a.k.a. Jalali, and Melinda Francis, a.k.a. Molly DocuVexen. And we came out of the box tonight with the real Spice Girls and real Don Cherry, who is from Los Angeles, California, and the fake Don Cherry, who is from Toronto, Canada, and the real Spice Girls are from Grenada, and the other Spice Girls. I really don't have any negative things to say about the other Spice Girl. They haven't done anything that I know about this counter revolutionary. But I thought that was a real nice take on the real Spice Girls. And they did a song called about the international airport in being named. It's called Maurice Bishop International. That's the airport. But I guess there's differences in terms of the way we speak English, because all the Grenadians that I know refer to Maurice as Maurice Bishop. And I guess there's potatoes, and the whole British Yankee Doodle Dandy thing, but I'm talking about the great one. Whether you call him Morris or you call him Maurice, you know who we are talking about. And Melinda Francis, how are you doing today?
I'm doing well. It's a little gray today in Toronto, but it's still kind of, temperate, so it's a good day.
Yeah, well, we lost a good friend of ours, a man, I don't know, you probably never met him, but we have interviewed him many times, Kenny Hamilton. He was from Montreal. He was I used to call him the Canadian Bama, because he was an R&B singer. He passed away peacefully, I guess it was yesterday, and we have interviewed him on Diasporic Music maybe five times.
I think we've done it together with him.
Right.
I would have to look back, but I'm sure we have.
And we're going to play some of his music, and we're going to be speaking with Emma Lewis out of the UK, and she's going to be talking about Black History Month England, and they celebrate Black History Month in October as opposed to February. So we're going to be speaking with her about that and many other issues. And we're also going to be talking to Dr. Gerald Horn. We wanted to get his take on the hurricane situation in the Caribbean and earthquakes and so on and so forth. And we also wanted to talk to him about some current events taking place. And have a good show. And is there anything else you'd like to add before we start, Melinda?
No, I just want to give a shout out to the Gorilla Crew. I went to a different book list yesterday for the 30th commemoration of Thomas Sankara. It was a full house. The movie was really good. So I want to congratulate Amis. We had him on the show last week, so I want to give a shout out to them.
And it's up on the internet now. It's up on our web page. It's up on WHO Radio, Black Power 96, and we're getting ready to listen to. Show that some young sisters did about the whole Grenadian Revolution, and we will be back with some music from Kenny Hamilton after we hear a great piece on Maurice Bishop.
It was once said that when you have a great history and legacy, it becomes one's duty to build on that history and that legacy and not regress. Today, We're going to talk about one of our ancestors who was inspired by the spirit of self-determination, independence, and justice. Brother Maurice Bishop of Grenada.
One of the greatest curses of colonialism was that they divided the region according to different metropolitan centers. They taught us different languages, and then they made a great play of the fact that you are Dutch speaking, you are Spanish speaking, you are French speaking, you are English speaking, and more recently, you are American speaking. And based on this linguistic nonsense, they taught us to hate each other. When we were growing up in school, they used to make us believe that the sun sets only in England.
Maurice Bishop was born in Aruba, May 29, 1944. His family migrated to Grenada when he was 6 years old. Maurice was a very gifted student who was involved in social issues at an early age. Influenced by profound black movements as a youth, Maurice and one of his friends, Bernard Cord, in 1962 founded an organization called Grenada Assembly of Youth After Truth. Maurice eventually moved to London to study law, and after attaining his law degree, practiced in the UK for 2 years. While there, he was the co-founder of a legal aid clinic and developed his interest in campaigns against racial discrimination, especially with black people from the Caribbean living in the UK. Returning to Grenada, Bishop became active in politics. And in 1973, he became head of the New Jewel Movement political party. He was elected to Parliament, and for several years he held the position of leader of the opposition in the Grenada House of Representatives, opposing the government of Prime Minister Eric Gehry and his Grenada United Labour Party. Maurice Bishop wanted to see a change for Grenada and its people. He was frustrated with the exploitation from the likes of Eric Gehry. So in 1979, he staged a revolution.
We had received information on the Saturday before the Tuesday that the intention of the government was to search us and detain us. We decided to go underground. While we were underground, more information came to us on the Monday morning that the plan was that Gehry was going to flee the country, leaving orders to have our leadership killed. We therefore, around 3 o'clock, summoned a council, a meeting of our top cadres, and there and then, the decision was taken that we should move.
Did you have outside help in staging and mounting this revolution?
The process was entirely independent, no outside help at all.
Bishop subsequently suspended the constitution and declared himself Prime Minister of Grenada. As Prime Minister of Grenada, Bishop developed the People's Revolutionary Government, and the New Jewel Movement began to shine its light on the world by developing the infrastructure of the country of Grenada.
A campaign to eat local has been necessary because colonialism encouraged the people for generations to think that expensive imported food was better. Local foods was symbolic of poverty.
In the agriculture sector, the government claimed a 26% increase in exports of cocoa, nutmegs, and bananas in the first year. But Grenadians are also being encouraged in a new effort to produce vegetables for self-sufficiency.
In just 4 years, the country developed in a profound manner. This was achieved by nationalizing the country's resources and advancing the development of education, of agriculture, and medicine.
With 400 years of private sector in Grenada and 400 years
of 8 million pounds of mangoes falling on the ground and rotting on trees throughout Grenada. It took the PRG to take those mangoes and to can and bottle them, put mango slices, mango juice, mango nectar, nutmeg jelly, tamarind juice, tamarind nectar, and all the other ranges of fruits and juices. All of them, first of all, researched, developed, perfected, and mass-produced by the People's Revolutionary Government after 400 years of presence.
He advanced the country more in that short time span than any advancement made under the 300-year rule of colonialism by the British Empire. Much of this advancement occurred with the assistance of Cuba and the political relationships developed between Fidel Castro and Maurice Bishop. The People's Revolutionary Group continued the work developing the country with plans of increasing one of their major exports, tourism.
Welcome to the island of Grenada.
They hoped to continue expanding the industry of tourism and agriculture by building an international airport. With financial assistance from Russia and Cuba, this airport would help to increase the economic infrastructure of Grenada.
Grenada is a fun and welcoming place for singles, couples, and families. Come to Grenada and put some spice in your life.
But this put the country of Grenada on the radar of the Ronald Reagan administration in 1980, with the claim fearing the rise of another communist nation.
The world has changed. Today, our national security can be threatened in faraway places. It's up to all of us to be aware of the strategic importance of such places and to be able to identify them.
Having another nation not under the control of European domination and successful could spread, causing a threat to global white supremacy. And that was in the plans for Maurice Bishop and Fidel Castro to build their nation and begin to connect and help other nations become self-sufficient and fight out the claws of white supremacy.
But the fact of the matter is, now they come from, they tell us they're speaking Dutch, do the best. This is English, do the best. French is the best. Spanish is the best. American is the best. And all of us hating each other. When in fact we are one people from one Caribbean. Therefore, it's one of our historic duties and responsibilities to pull down these artificial barriers of colonialism and to develop that one nation. We believe it is critically necessary for our association with all of our neighbors. That is why I have done state visits to Mexico, to Venezuela, to Panama, to Cuba, to Nicaragua, to Ecuador. The reason has been a conscious attempt on the part of this new government to try to build those bridges and to make sure that all of this alienation of the past disappears.
And for the Ronald Reagan administration, of course, this was a major problem. The Reagan administration would launch a propaganda campaign against Bishop and the New Jewel movement that would cut into their tourism finances with the goal of crippling the economy.
In 1979, trouble came to Grenada. Maurice Bishop, a protege of Fidel Castro, staged a military coup and overthrew the government which had been elected under the Constitution left to the people by the British. He sought the help of Cuba in building an airport, which he claimed was for tourist trade, but which looked suspiciously suitable for military aircraft, including Soviet-built long-range bombers.
And Ronald Reagan didn't stop there.
We have to struggle as people who are being destabilized every day to get people out there to understand the really devastating effects of propaganda.
According to the Bureau, it had received complaints about mass torture being practiced by the Bishop government.
You get this whole question of the disinformation being hidden behind the facade of a free press and a free media generally.
Maurice Bishop was fully aware of the tactics of white supremacy, increased propaganda to gain mass support to justify invading and crushing the self-determination and independence of other nations.
in exactly the same way that they have had to move to violent force against other popular progressive revolutions around the world. They are right now, this very minute, sitting down and planning the final stages of their armed attack against our revolution.
Unfortunately, inner strife in the New Jewel movement developed, and this split was spearheaded by a longtime comrade of Bishop, once considered a friend, Bernard Cord, along with General Hudson Austin. Cord was serving as the Revolutionary Government's Minister of Finance, Trade and Industry, as well as the Deputy Prime Minister under Bishop. A dispute developed within the senior ranks of the party. A majority faction of the party's Central Committee, under Cord's leadership, demanded that Bishop either step down or enter into a power-sharing agreement with Cord, where both men would share control of the government. Bishop and his faction refused this lead to an overthrow, but was eventually placed under house arrest during the first week of October 1983 by Cord. This did not sit well with the people of Grenada, who Maurice Bishop had been fighting for. Large demonstrations on various parts of the island broke out, demanding Bishop's freedom and restoration. During one demonstration, the crowd freed Bishop from house arrest. Bishop made his way to the Army headquarters at Fort Rupert, known today as Fort George. Once Bishop was freed, the plans from Cord and Austin backfired. They dispatched a military force. Fighting broke out, many civilians were killed, and Bishop, along with seven others, including cabinet members, were captured. General Hudson proclaimed himself head of the Revolutionary Military Council. Later on the evening of October 19th, they were executed by a four-man People's Revolutionary Army firing squad. This was the opportunity that the Reagan administration had been waiting and preparing for, and quickly took advantage of the inner strife taking place. The United States then launched Operation Urgent Fury on October 25th. Hudson Austin's military government was removed, and constitutional government resumed afterwards with the claim of protecting U.S. citizens in Grenada and saving the world from the evils of communism.
Neighboring Caribbean democracies, the brave young soldiers, sailors, marines, and airmen accomplished their mission. They went to Grenada not to conquer, but to liberate. And they did. They saved the people, they captured tons of Soviet military equipment, and they averted a hostage crisis before it happened.
The United States, as it happens, didn't have much interest in or concern with Grenada until Maurice Bishop and the Revolution of 1979. Now, that was under the Carter administration, you'll recall, the Human Rights Administration, the peak of humanitarianism. The Carter administration was bitterly antagonistic to the Grenadian Revolution from the first minute and reacted exactly the way the United States reacts to all moves for independence. The first priority for the countries is U.S. investors. They must be service areas. They're supposed to provide cheap labor, resources, markets, investment opportunities, these days opportunities for export of pollution and so on. That's the job, the service areas. And if you depart from that job, no matter how or in what way, you will be punished.
Afterwards, the British stepped back in, placing Paul Scoon back in the position of governor. And the advancements that Grenada made in just 4 years were reversed, and the country was once again back under the control of white supremacists. We salute our noble, brave ancestor who died young seeking to establish nationhood and respect for his people, and learn from his example so that we too can continue to strive for freedom and independence. Let us be inspired by his words, forward ever, backwards never. Why have they singled out our poor small country? Why do we stimulate so much fear in the minds of Reagan and his warlords? We have no great industries, no great banks, no gold, no oil, no diamonds, few natural resources. There is one distinguishing feature, we in small, tiny, but free. Grenada led the first socialist revolution in the English-speaking Caribbean. Our revolution has challenged the carefully built-up myth that we are too small, too weak, and cowardly to stand up to dictatorship. The revolution smashed this illusion. This revolution is also a big threat being in a black country, because the U.S. holds captive millions of black people in racist bondage. They are afraid that black Americans may find out and be inspired by the Grenada Revolution.
Long live the Grenada Revolution! Long live the fighting people of Grenada!
Uhuru, you are listening to Diasporic Music on Black Power 96. Melinda Francis, Norman Richman, and we're getting ready to pay tribute to Kenny Hamilton, who joined the ancestors. And Kenny Hamilton, we have doves and we have hawks in soul music. And Kenny Hamilton was one of the hawks in R&B, Canadian R&B. And he and Glenn Ricketts, the father of Glenn Lewis, were the hawks, and the dove was Jay McGee. But Kenny Hamilton, he joined the ancestors, and we're going to pay tribute to him, and we're probably going to do a whole half an hour on him in the weeks to come, probably next week. So let's listen to Kenny Hamilton and get ready for Emma Lewis from Britain or the UK. Thank you.
Can you tell me where Kim lives?
Yes, upstairs, over there.
Thanks, mister. Let's see now. One, two, three. Ah, here's the door.
Who is it?
It's me, baby. No, wait. Don't close the door. I have something I would like to say to you. You see, I was just released from the hospital. The reason I was released was because the doctors told me they couldn't do me no good. And they told me that they haven't found a remedy for my condition. They told me that what I had was beyond medical science. They told me that what I had was more serious than cancer. They said, Kenny, what you have is a very, very bad case of the blues. the best remedy for the blues is to be with the one you love. And that's why I can stand up, and I'm not ashamed, not ashamed to say these words. Right here is where you
Black Power.
You are listening to Diasporic Music on Black Power 96. Melinda Francis and Norman Richmond, and we are attempting to get a hold of Emma Lewis in the UK. We cannot get a hold of her, but we were listening to Kenny Hamilton, and Kenny Hamilton, right Back Where You Belong, was recorded in Toronto, and the producer of that particular song is a young man by the name of Kingsley Etienne. And Kingsley was born in Grenada, and most of the musicians on that particular song were from Caribbean Brothers, and the label it was on was Monica's label, and they are a Jamaican couple, and they specialized in R&B music during that particular period. And Kenny Hamilton had a great album during that period on Monica's, I guess it was the Monica label or Scorpio. Can't think of it right now. But we are going to attempt to get Emma Lewis, and I guess right now we're going to play some music from Grenada. We're going to listen to The Flying Turkey.
We'll be right back. world situation is so complex, who can understand people aren't. And every day people expressing different interpretations. Let us analyze just a little more. Our inner thoughts more deeply explore. Pushing our feelings away. Be more objective, I say. Even if it's hard, we still have to try. We have to recognize the conditions that brought us to. Then determine which way we want to go. Because it seems to get big as black dog. Is the same now, we'll strike the wind. So for Grenada's sake, we have no choice but to unite. That's right. And let those who dwell among us, without sin, cast the first stone. Show me a man who has not done wrong. Each one wants to blame his adversary and hide his own fault. But tell me, how long can this game go on? Where is the love, my people? Where is the unity? We have to build a home on trust and integrity. We have to elevate our sense of strength and purpose. We have to understand that this fight silence must come first. Stroke to build a nation, do not forget people. Alright. There were times when we all were proud and times that we all regret people. Sometimes we acted so insensibly. Treated our own brothers carelessly. Politicians criticize, native sons were ostracized, wolves and sheep clothing parading disguise. The evils that were done we contemplate every day, yet the good deeds we quickly hide away. But if the right hand gets a cancer, well the whole body feels the pain. So we must gather strength and start building our home again. No spring. And let those who dwell among us, without sins, cast the first stone. Show me a man who has not done wrong. Like crabs in a barrel, we only pulling each other down. But tell me, how long can this thing go on? We have to rise from the gloomy depths of hypocrisy. Let us reconcile differences and try unity. It is a duty, people, a responsibility. For our children's sake, for the love of our country. So government stop exporting talents to foreign nations. Make us feel that we can return home to give a hand. Cause the task of responding to our nation's call is not only on one, but it depends on all.
Remember when killing and fighting were things we only heard about people? Alright. There will be better days, more prosperity. Yes, I have no doubt, people. If we want to rebuild this spice island, free of drugs, war, and corruption. Politicians, please, I say, abandon your power play. Work towards the dawning of a new day. The world economy is unhealthy, yes, that is true. Bigger nations sneeze and we catch the flu. Yet if we manage our scarce resources properly, we might just get by. So for our future's sake, let's get up and give it a try. No lies. And let those who dwell among us without sins cast the first stone. Show me a man who has not done wrong. Political parties, stop condemning your predecessors. Let us build a nation on pride and integrity. No one else can take this responsibility. No, no. And while we struggle along the way of our journey, just remember that Grenada still belongs to we. Yeah. And no America, no superpower can solve our problems. In the end, when they're gone, we will still be free. With them, and we will remain with one great mission. Make Grenada the gem of the Caribbean. Where is the love, my people? Where is our unity? We have to build a home on trust and integrity. Yeah. We have to elevate our sense of strength and
you are listening to Dire Sport Music on Black Power 96, Melinda Francis Norman, which moment we are paying tribute to the Grenadian Revolution. And Melinda, is how much work or how is the Caribbean Solidarity Network dealing with Grenada has had many, many, many hurricanes, but how is Grenada in not in the pecking order, but Grenada in terms of, I guess, the worst situation, I presume probably is Barbuda, right?
Oh, yeah. Barbuda, and I would say, well, and Dominica was totally decimated. So Barbuda had to evacuate everybody, but Dominica also was completely destroyed. And then, of course, there's Puerto Rico that has been sitting a third of it without power for, I don't know, it's been like over a month now, I think. Okay, I can't remember. Like 3 weeks, maybe. So I believe that there's people in Puerto Rico that don't have power still. But Barbuda had to be totally evacuated. So yeah, it was definitely the worst off. But at the same time, Antigua was able to evacuate everything. So, like, the comparison of, like, Antigua's reaction, and Antigua actually was dealing with Barbuda when they were actually supporting Dominica. So you see the contrast from, you know, the smaller islands or the islands or the regional powers, like, you know, kind of coming together. And then you have Puerto Rico, who is a colony of U.S., has no support. So you see the contrast pretty stark.
So I guess what we're going to do is listen to some Maurice Bishop speaking, and it appears that we cannot get a hold of Emma Lewis this week, but we will continue to try to connect with her at another time. But we're going to listen to some. This is Maurice Bishop at Hunter's College. I think this was in 1983. Yeah, 1983. And in 1984, I was in New York City, and I was at Hunter's College. And I remember I was with a young woman from she was from born in New York of she was Bajan and Grenadian background, and I remember we sat there and we were at a concert for Royal Airs, and I was basically we were talking about the fact this was the same place probably a year earlier that Maurice Bishop actually delivered the speech that we're getting ready to listen to. This is this is the ceremony that took place at Hunter's College. Now, whether it's Maurice Bishop speaking, we have not having some technical issues. So, but this is Hunter's College, October, I believe, 1983.
This place, Hunter College, has been made possible to us by the Department of Black and Puerto Rican Studies. That being so, it is just fitting that someone from that department tell us something. We now call on Dr. David Hodges to be honored.
Thank you. I am pleased to bring greetings from Hunter College and specifically the Department of Black and Puerto Rican Studies to the Honorable Prime Minister, to the honored guests, and to all of you who are assembled this afternoon. There is a quotation on the south side of this building that on the 68th Street side of the building that states, we may be of differing opinions at differing hours, but we must always be on the side of the pursuit of truth. Hunter College once again extends its platform in the quest for truth. And the Department of Black and Puerto Rican Studies here at Hunter College is pleased to join hands with all the other sponsoring organizations in welcoming the Honorable Prime Minister and all of you who have gathered and who honor us by your presence here today. Thank you very much.
Uhuru, you are listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. Linda Francis, and we have connected with Emma Lewis from the UK. And how are you doing today? I guess you had an incident.
Yeah, I'm okay, thank you.
I guess we have the one question we have for you. We only have, about 10 minutes. Could you talk about Black History Month being in October and why it's not in February and just the origin and the history of Black History Month in October in the UK?
Well, Black History Month really came about because of the conditions that our people faced here. As you know, the slaves in England, most of them were actually sent to Sierra Leone when the Americans had their so-called revolution. And but black people have been in Britain for a very long time, since the 15th century. But since the migration that came from the Caribbean during the 1948, 50, and so on, after our people had come over to help fight the imperialist war, our situation really deteriorated, and there were a lot of rebellions in that year. I think it was 1887. There was a lot of uprisings, and the powers that be decided that they would make certain concessions because the people were willing to take it to the streets. So the acknowledgement that we were, that we had a history, that we had a culture, you know, that we were human beings and that we were willing to fight to be acknowledged, meant that they had to do something. So a few people were, some black people, Diane Abbott, Paul Botain, two others, I think, no, one other, three people were elected to Parliament, and they started this agitation to recognize our history, that black history be taught in the schools and so forth, and certain kind of celebration would go on in October. So that's what happened, because we weren't, you know, we definitely didn't, they didn't want it to be the same as the Americans, same month.
February was because of Carter G. Woodson, and many people maintain that it was because of Abraham Lincoln, but it was really because of Frederick Douglass's birthday. But you have a question, Melinda? Because we have about, I guess we have about 9 minutes.
Well, I just wanted to kind of follow up because you mentioned that, you know, Africans have been in the UK since the, what was it, the 15th century, you said?
Yes.
What was the context behind that when, you know, at that time?
How do you mean, how we got here?
Yeah, basically when the first people came in Britain, what was the context behind that, so that listeners sort of know a little bit about that?
Oh,
that's
well,
a long time, yeah.
Yeah, it was a long time ago.
Yes,
indeed. Well, the slave trade, so-called trade, which wasn't a trade as you know, but they started taking us away from Africa and, you know, taking us across to the Caribbean and so forth. And they decided that they would keep some people here. They had people here working as servants. I don't know if you know what that is. It's people who do your housework primarily.
Domestic.
That's right. So when the Americans had their so-called revolution, is it 1776? When the Americans rebelled against the British government, then some black people fought on the side of the British because they wanted to end, you know, their oppression, and they thought this was a way out. They became very unpopular afterwards, and so they went to Canada, and the British took those people along with the black people who were in Britain, and they took them and put them in Sierra Leone. So that's what happened then. There were other black people here who, for example, after the war, there were many mixed people who were, you know, because of the American soldiers, and they were put on a ship and sent to America. And I went into the archives and checked, and there was no trace of what happened to them after they went on that ship to America. So we don't know what happened to those people. But a cemetery was excavated some time ago, and they found a whole, you know, a mass grave of black people. So we don't know what happened there either. There are a lot of gaps in what has happened to us.
Mm-hmm.
you see, because they just don't, I mean, Kew Gardens, they've got the some archives up there, but recently we found out that most of the stuff to do with colonial, the colonial countries and so forth, in particular the plantations and the money and so forth that they got from that, those archive, those documents are actually not kept at Kew, and they won't allow us access to that material. As you know, the past Prime Minister, David Cameron, his family made their fortune out of the selling of black bodies, mm-hmm. but these things are not allowed to come up in polite company.
Right. And well, just to follow up, the last time, you know, Cameron was in Jamaica, he basically said, you know, Jamaicans should get over it.
Indeed.
Indeed. Yeah.
Yeah, and the Jamaicans, well, you can't blame all the Jamaicans, but the mad woman that they had as their prime minister actually accepted his proposal to give them money to build a prison.
Right.
But, I mean, this beggars belief, but then these things happen.
Yeah, because I guess Jamaica, like every other society in the world, is a class society, and you got a right, you have a left, and you have some of the most revolutionary people on the planet have come from Jamaica, and you also have a set of people that are pretty backward.
Yes, that's true.
We.
Yeah, it was an insult. It was an insult to us, to our history of struggle, you know, to all the people, you know, Sam Sharp, Paul Bogle, you know, the people who had, you know, given their lives for our freedom and for us to live like human beings. And then you have this stupid man who's never done a day's work in his life and who's living off the oppression and exploitation of other people, dare to tell us that what we need is a prison.
So we have a few seconds left. Can we interview you next week at the same time, or we can talk? We have a few minutes after we go off the air, but is that possible to talk to you next week?
Yes, of course. Yes, no problem.
Yeah, because I know you're very, 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 very dependable. So when we didn't hear from you, I was kind of worried, you know.
Okay. No. Maybe I'll just hop in with my stick to get to the phone.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm laughing because I have a. I have a cane too, so I can relate to that 1,000%. With the canes of the world unite.
Yes, that's right. Okay.
You start an organization.
Yes, that's right. That's right. I don't know what we'd call ourselves, though. Peg legs of the world.
Yeah, nothing to lose but your cane.
Yes, that's right. I've got a metal stick that the hospital gave me, so it's not even a cane. Okay. So I'll talk to you next week.
Yes? Yes.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you.
Thank you. Goodbye.
All right. We have been listening to Emma Lewis from the UK, and we are getting ready to pay tribute to, we're going to salute Minister Louis Farrakhan, a.k.a. the Charmer. Louis Farrakhan was a Calypsonian called the Charmer, and he was quite good. And we're going to listen to him sing. And we're also going to hear Prince Buster And we will be back in with Gerald Horn at the next spoken word part. So we will see you in the whirlwind.
Black Power, 96.3 FM, Southside St. Pete's own community radio station, WBPU, Black People United.
Assalamu alaikum. We are getting ready to pay tribute to Minister Louis Farrakhan, a.k.a. the Charmer. Minister Farrakhan was once a calypso singer, and we're going to let you listen to a little bit of the Charmer and then some Louis Farrakhan.
That's why they're hip-hop generation. That's why they're rapping today. You don't understand what they're doing. I don't either, brother, but it's all right. Look, when I was a young boy, 150 years ago, I used to sing calypso. And the art of calypso singing is you make up rhymes on the spot. It's called improvisation. But you sing it. I saw the lady in she white garment, and I wonder what was her sentiment. I saw the lady in she garment, but I wonder what was she sentiment. She looking at me with she eye big, and I wonder if she think I man or a pig. I don't know what the woman thinking, but I wonder had the woman been drinking. Why you drinking? I want me rum and Coca-Cola. Wait. I'm not trying to entertain. I'm not trying to do that. But what I'm saying is, do you know the kind of skill it takes for a young boy to get up and rap like these children are doing and rhyme like they're rhyming and get that rhythm? Like, man, that is the high form of mathematics. Our children are gone and we got to catch up to where they are. Put some wisdom there and let them rap the wisdom of God.
A New York cemetery was a Jumbi jamboree took place in Woodlawn Cemetery. Jumbis from all parts of the island, some of them are great Calypsonian. Since this season was carnival, they got together in Bacchanal and they singing
back to back, belly to belly. I don't hear a dan, I don't get a ready. Back to back, belly to belly was a Jumbi jamboree.
I hear the chorus
back to back, belly to belly. I don't hear a dan, I don't get a ready. Back to back, belly to belly was a Jumbi jamboree.
How she jumping on the grave. In one hand she holding a quarter rum, with the other hand she knocking conga drum. The lead singer start to make his rhyme, while the other jumbi rattling their bones in time. One bystander had this to say, it was a treat to see the jumbi break away. And what they singing?
Back to back, belly to belly. I don't hear a dan, I don't dead already. Back to back, belly to belly was a Jumbi jamboree.
I hear the chorus
back to back, belly to belly. I don't care a dan, I don't get a ready. Back to back,
belly to belly was a jumbi jamboree. Left and right things getting sweet. Silly bystander mash the jumbi feet. The jumbi raise his finger to warn. He say, mister, take care, you mash me corn. The funniest thing you could ever see was a jumbi eating codfish and punji. I never see more mobby or ginger bear than at the jumbi parade which took place last year. And what they singing?
Back to back, belly to belly, I don't care a damn, I don't dead already. Back to back, belly to belly was a jumbi jamboree.
I hear the chorus.
Back to back, belly to belly, I don't care a damn, I don't dead already. Back to back, belly to belly was a jumbi jamboree.
Uhuru, you are listening to Gaius Fork Music on Black Power 96. My name is Norman Otis Richmond, a.k.a. Jalali, along with Melinda Francis, a.k.a. Molly Docuvexin, and we're doing a tribute to Minister Louis Farrakhan. We heard Minister Louis Farrakhan when he was called the Charmer. He was a calypsonian, and he did a classic calypso called Back to Back, Belly to Belly, and we the hour off with Minister Louis Farrakhan explaining talking about hip hop and how it's kind of similar to calypso in many ways in terms of being extemporaneous. And we are getting ready to play a song that was done by Prince Buster, the late Prince Buster. He passed away. But Prince Buster was a record man and a businessman, and he was based in Kingston, Jamaica. He converted to Islam, and he was converted to Islam. He was influenced by Muhammad Ali and Sam Cooke, and he recorded Minister Louis Farrakhan's A White Man's Heaven is a Black Man's Hell and put it in reggae, and then we're going to hear Minister Louis Farrakhan do Heed the Call, Y'all, A White Man's Heaven is a Black Man's Hell.
Chapter 2, A White Man's Heaven is a Black Man's Hell. No slave master wants the slave to be his equal. No housewife wants the maid to sleep in her bed. So this is history. When John Atkins showed up in her country, telling us of a land filled with luxury, he said, "Black man, follow me to Jamaica. There you'd find more gold for your labor, or poor parents' work, the corn to his bone. Ever since that time, he's been wrestling with the gold. We landed here in Kingston, Jamaica, 400 years to suffer. So, my friends, it's easy to tell that the white man's heaven is the black man's hell. When the slave master wanted to have some sport, he would eat up on our parents, cruelty of the worst sort, like burn them on steak and them on tree. Though you're a pregnant black woman, you pull the plow, like a horse, like a dog, or even a cow. He filled your womb with his wicked seed, his half-white children you're made to breed. So my friends, it's easy to tell that the white man's heaven is the black man's hell. When the white man came to Jamaica, he told the Arawak, I'm your white brother. He said, red man, I treat you the best, yet then silly push them Arawaks further west. With his white woman and fire water, tricks and lies, he's told Jamaica. So-called Negroes, open up your eyes, black man everywhere is on the rise. He has kicked the white man out of Asia, and he's going fast out of Africa. With every ounce of strength and breath,
His cries, give us liberty or give us death. The whole black world has risen up anew to see what the so-called Negro is going to do. So, my friends, it's easy to tell that the white man's heaven is a black man's heaven. God made a promise to Abraham that his seed would be a stranger in a foreign land. They would suffer and be afflicted 400 years. Then he would come and wipe their tears. Our God and Savior, Allah's come, and he's prophesied the white man's days done. Divine messenger, one prophesied to come, his name Elijah. Look in Malachi 4. We now can stand up the whole world to tell, for God has come to take us to heaven and push the devil back in hell. So my friends, it's not hard to tell that the white man's heaven is the black man's hell. Take those white pictures from off of your walls.
You are listening to Diaspora Spoke Music on Uhuru Radio, and we are paying tribute to Minister Louis Farrakhan. And Minister Louis Farrakhan was born in Boston, and his mother was from St. Kitts Nevis. His father was from Jamaica, and he grew up. He won Ted Mack Amateur Hour, for those of you who are, I guess, in your 100 years old, you might remember the Ted Mack Amateur Hour. I think Gladys Knight, she was on there. But Minister Louis Farrakhan won a talent show there, and he was playing his violin. And he was influenced by, he heard Malcolm X, and then he joined the Nation of Islam. And I guess the rest is history.
Spiritually deaf, dumb, and blind. Why is everybody making progress, yet we seem to be lagging so far behind? Why are we mistreated? Why are we in this condition, stripped of our names, our language, our culture, our country, our God, and our religion? All of religious training has been gotten through the preacher. And he has told us of a heaven way up in the sky that we can't enjoy now, but rather after we die. But all of the years that we're living, for us there's nothing but hell, pain, torture, and misgiving. Yet the Bible speaks of a heaven filled with material luxury, which the white man and the preacher has right here, so we see. So my friend, take it for what it's worth. Heaven and hell are just two conditions of life, and they're both right here on this earth. Back into history, which rewards our research and tells us plainly that before the white man gained entry to the East, he was living in the caves of Europe on the level of the beast, eating the bark of trees and eating flesh raw, till God sent Moses to civilize him and teach him the law. Then following many of his explorers, he gained entry into Asia and Africa. From China, he took silk and gunpowder. From India, he took jute, manganese, and rubber. He raped Africa of her diamonds and her gold. And from the Mideast, he took barrels of oil untold, deceiving, raping, robbing, and murdering everything in his path. The whole black world has tasted of the white man's wrath. So my friend, it's not hard to tell, a white man's hell is a black man's hell. Before we came to America, we were living in the East by the Nile River, living in luxury, enjoying freedom, justice, and equality. We wore silken robes and slippers of gold. We were the wealthiest and the wisest people I'm told. Now we are the poorest of the poor. Nobody wants us at their door. So my friend, it's easy to tell, white man heaven is a black man hell. White man came to America, he told the Indian, I am your white brother. He said, red man, I'll treat you the best. Yet until he pushed the Indian further west, with his white woman and fire water, tricks and lies he stole America. The original owner of this nation is cooped up on a reservation. Oh, my friend, it's easy to tell that a white man heaven is a black man hell. He needed someone to work the land. His back was too weak. He needed you, black man. So he commissioned Sir John Hawkins to commit the world's most grievous sin, to take a man who's born to be free.
and bring him down to slavery, to sell a man as merchandise. On his body put a price. So my friend, it's easy to tell that a white man heaven is a black man hell.
He's a liar. It's easy to tell. White man heaven is a
in our country, telling us of a land filled with luxuries. He said, black man, follow me to America. There you find more gold for your labor. Our forbearance were tricked onto his boat. Since that time we've been wrestling with the gold. We landed here in Jamestown, Virginia, 400 years to suffer. So my friend, it's easy to tell, white man heaven is a black man hell.
Thank you.
God said to Abram, "Know of a surety that thy seed will be a stranger in a land that is not theirs. And they shall serve them, and they shall afflict them 400 years. But after that time I will come, and I will judge that nation which they shall serve."
White man's day is done. He has given us a divine messenger, one prophesied to come. His name is Elijah. We now can stand up. The whole wide world to tell, our God has come to give us heaven and take the devil into
spiritually deaf, dumb, and blind? Why is everybody making progress, yet we seem to be lagging so far behind? Why are we mistreated? Why are we in this condition, stripped of our names, our language, our culture, our country, our God, and our religion? Thank you.
religious training has been gotten through the preacher. And he has told us of a heaven way up in the sky that we can't enjoy now, but rather after we die. But all of the years that we're living for us...
You are listening to Diasporic Music on Black Power 96. My name is Norman Richmond, along with Mr. Francis. And we just heard Minister Louis Farrakhan singing "A White Man's." He called "A White Man's Heaven is a Black Man's Hell." And when my grandmother, Miss Richmond, she was a Glover. I gave her that 45, and when she passed away, she played it till the grooves were gone. But we were getting ready to talk to Dr. Gerald Horn, and Dr. Horn holds the Moore's Professorship of History and African American Studies. His research has addressed issues of racism in a variety of relations involving labor, politics, civil rights, international relations, and war. He has also written extensively about the film industry. Dr. Horn received his PhD in history from Columbia University and his JD from the University of California, Berkeley, and his BA from Princeton University. Dr. Horn's undergraduate courses include the Civil Rights Movement and U.S. history through film. He teaches graduate courses in diplomatic history, labor history, the 20th century African-American history, and Dr. Horn uses a variety of teaching techniques that enrich his classes and motivate students to participate. How are you doing today, Mr. Horn?
Fine, thank you.
I think Melinda wants to ask you the first question, I guess, about the hurricane situation.
Yeah, we have been, the last few weeks, been talking about the hurricanes that swept across the Caribbean and, the implications of climate change on the region. So what are your impressions? I know you experienced Hurricane Harvey, but, watching it from the States, the ongoing hurricanes that happened from Irma to Nate now?
Well, obviously it's been disastrous. I'm particularly concerned about its impact on the Caribbean. I'm sure you've heard that the island of Barbuda, which supposedly had 300 continuous years of African presence, no longer has an African presence, and hopefully that's not the canary in the mine that signals a similar fate for many other islands, although certainly we have to be concerned about climate change, and particularly the fact that one of the world's most significant defilers of the environment, speaking of the United States of America, has decided to withdraw from the Paris Climate Accord. We know that climate change helps to intensify these storms. I'm not sure if even experts will go so far as to suggest that they initiate these storms, but they certainly intensify their ferocity. And this is something we're all going to have to be concerned about going forward.
Are you listening to Diasporic Music on Black Power 96? I wanted to ask you, unless you wanted to elaborate more on that, but the next question, if you have anything else to say, you can continue. But the next question I want to ask you is about so-called separatism, Catalonia and Cameroons. I think the English-speaking people in the Cameroon are talking about creating their own nation state, and Catalonia is trying to separate from Spain. Could I get your thoughts, or can we get your thoughts on that issue?
Well, I think your Canadian audience will be interested in this first point. A few weeks ago on KPFK in Los Angeles, I was involved in a brief dialogue with some Cameroonian activists from the Anglosphere, so to speak. They're part of this English-speaking group that is claiming that they're being oppressed and persecuted by the so-called French-speaking group led by President Paul Biya, who has been in power for decades. And what concerned me is that I recommended that they touch base with our friends in Canada, given Canada's long history in trying to grapple with French-English contradictions, amongst others. And I thought that Canadians might have something useful to add to the discussion in Cameroon. But what concerned and disturbed me was they didn't seem to be interested, well, quite frankly. I mean, I didn't know how to take that. I didn't know if it was because they see Canada as a capitalist country and even activists would have nothing to add or what. And so, I don't know, you may want to come in on that. Now, with regard to Catalonia, what I find striking about that particular separatist movement in Spain is that in some ways what's happening in Catalonia is an analog to what happened in Scotland just a few years ago when Scotland tried to withdraw from the United Kingdom and probably will try again. And you may recall that in my 1776 book, I talked about the fact that at the beginning of the 18th century, the beginning of the 1700s, you basically had a takeoff of settler colonialism. You had a takeoff of the African slave trade. You had a takeoff of capitalism. And to a certain extent, London helped to buy off the Scots by enlisting them in that escapade. The ferocious conflict between the Scots and the English. And likewise, about 1713, 1714, as I mentioned in the book, you basically have the accession of Catalonia through violent means, understandably, to Madrid's rule. And then afterwards, you had Catalans heavily implicated in the colonial project in the 18th century. And now, in the 21st century, the low-hanging fruit of colonialism have basically dried up, and there's not that much to buy off these minorities, the Catalans or the Scots. And so, therefore, they're reverting to the status quo ante of three centuries earlier, to the early 1700s. That was my analysis of both Catalan separatism and Scottish separatism. But in any case, you have any comment on that Cameroon situation?
That is kind of disheartening in the sense that, as an African person born in North America, at one point we didn't want to listen to anything Europeans had to say because it was invalid. But when we came to our senses, you know, truth is truth, and you can learn from anyone. It's like, for example, if you're going to study a guerrilla warfare, are you going to read Nkrumah's book on revolutionary warfare, who never really fought a warfare, guerrilla warfare? Are you going to read Jap or, you know, somebody from Vietnam who actually won that convention? So I'm just saying that's very disheartening to hear that our brothers and sisters from the Cameroon are that narrow in their thinking. Were they young people, or were they middle age, or do you know?
I don't know. I was talking to them on the radio, so I didn't have a chance to look at them. But I also interpreted it as just like Scottish separatism and Catalan separatism. I interpreted it also in terms of Cameroon is that they want to control this region, and they feel, since they're literate and educated, that they all play a leading role if the region of Cameroon becomes independent. And so, therefore, they were not necessarily interested in conciliation with the so-called Francophone sphere as a direct result.
Well, Catalonia, I just found out a couple of days ago that Scottish is, that's a whole, the thing, the Scottish connection with Catalonia is, I guess Catalonia has ties to a Scottish, is there such a thing as Scottish imperialism, or is it Scottish, there's no such thing as Scottish imperialism.
Well, I thought, was that the British imperialism, as I suggested a moment ago? And let me Technically, here, I just finished, and I just sent off to the publisher, this new book, The Apocalypse of Settler Colonialism, The Roots of Slavery, White Supremacy, and Capitalism in North America and the Caribbean in the 17th century. And in many ways, it's a prelude to what we were just discussing about the rise of British imperialism in the 18th century and the rise of Spanish imperialism in the 18th century. And it'll be out in January, and I recommend it to your listeners. And I should also say, since I'm talking about this subject, that my book on the Black Press, The Rise and Fall of the Associated Negro Press, dropped in August. And my book on aviation...
I don't want to cut you, but that book on I've been on Facebook, that book on the Black Press, I would be remiss. I have to apologize because I was supposed to send you some of those things, but you seem to have a pretty on Facebook. By the way, there's a lot of people interested in your book on the Black Press. Lots of people.
Well. I'm glad to hear it, and we shall see.
Okay, we're speaking to Dr. Gerald Horn, and before I want to let Melinda ask you some questions, but there's two questions I want to ask you. Could you talk about the fact that this is Al Prentice Bunchy Carter's 75th birthday, or was Al Prentice's 75th birthday, which was October the 12th, and could you talk about your time in Los Angeles, California? I know you did... S1 books and so on and so forth. Could you talk about those two situations?
Well, as you know more than most, Bunchy Carter was a leader of the Southern California Black Panther Party. As you may recall, some decades ago in the flower of his youth, he was killed on the UCLA campus as a direct result of a political and ideological dispute. Although some would say that those who killed him were manipulated by the powers of the state. In any case, you may also recall that when I was teaching at the University of Southern California, one of my prized pupils was his daughter, Danon Carter. I've lost track with her. I'm not sure where she is today. And that's a segue to talk about some days ago about the book on the Black Press and the book on aviation. I'll be back there in February to talk about the 17th century book and another book that's coming out in January on Afro-Asian solidarity. And I'm looking forward to that. The Essawan event a few days ago was taped by this network here in the United States, C-SPAN. And I assume that they'll find a time and place to broadcast it sooner rather than later.
All right, you're listening to Dr. Gerald Horn. And Melinda, you have some questions? No.
Yeah, I guess we haven't talked to you about basically the football boycotts and the take the knee movement that's happening, and maybe comment a little bit around that situation.
Oh, I will, but tell me, has it spread to the CFL?
No.
It is spread. Ita Sadu's brother is Joel Ward. He's a hockey player for San Jose, and he has threatened to take a knee.
Well, there was another hockey player whose name escapes me, who made some sort of manifestation a few days ago. And you might have also seen in a German football or soccer game just a day or so ago, in solidarity, They did the same thing. So it's spreading globally.
Wow.
But, you know, I've been speaking quite a bit about this, and Mr. Trump, I'm afraid, knows more about U.S. politics than some of our progressive friends, because he recognizes that within the 63 million people who voted for him, which is about twice as big as the entire Canadian population, there is a deep-seated resentment to black people who are successful. Particularly black people who are successful who protest the status quo, because their idea is that they're being ungrateful, even though we know that in some ways these athletes, these black athletes who are protesting police terror, are engaged in an act
of self-protection, since as a result of that race-class antagonism, oftentimes police are more likely to stop a black man in particular who's driving a Mercedes than driving a Ford Fiesta. So this protest, needless to say, has been greeted with derision by the Trump base. I noticed in the New York Times today there's an article about Howard University, the historically black college in Washington, D.C., where the cheerleaders have been taking a knee before Howard football games. So this is a significant protest, and in many ways it's consistent with the tradition of black American protests. I mean, for example, Denmark Vesey, who led a major slave revolt in South Carolina 195 years ago, was not a slave. He was a free Negro. He had won his freedom, but instead of being satisfied with his non-slave status, he decided to try to overthrow the entire system. And once again, I think this was enlightened self-interest on his part, because the status, even of free Negroes, was rather perilous. I mean, you could be kidnapped into slavery, which often happened. Many times it happened, in fact. So this is a very important movement, and I take my hat off to Colin Kaepernick, the former San Francisco 49ers quarterback who launched this entire movement.
Speaking with Dr. Gerald Horn, I wanted to say that there was a young man by the name of Ted Watkins who played, he was a halfback in the Canadian, he played for the Hamilton Tiger Cats, and he was with we had an organization here called the Afro-American Progressive Association, and he spoke, and he won the Grey Cup, which is like the Canadian Super Bowl, and he was very outspoken. There's pictures of him putting a coffin in front of the U.S. consulate, you know, around the time that King was killed and a lot of protests were taking place. He was killed, and they said he was robbing a store, I guess, in 1968 in California. And I've been trying to get people to, like, do some research on him. I talk to people. I know people that are in the industry, and it's like it's almost like it's a dead issue. No one is talking about it. Have you ever heard of Ted Watkins?
I heard of him through Norman Otis Richmond, a.k.a. Jalali.
That's the only it was a big story, because he was like, can you imagine, you win the Super Bowl, and then it was many, many years ago, but I guess that's on African people and progressive people to keep that story and keep his memory alive and try to resolve what really happened.
Hey, can I make another point? Let me engage in some crowdsourcing here. I know you have a highly literate and intelligent audience. And, you know, after submitting this latest book on 17th century slavery and the rise of slavery, the rise of the slave trade, white supremacy and capitalism, I have a desire to go back further, to try to seek out the roots of white supremacy and the roots of racism, which, of course, are two analytically distinct subjects. And I'm not sure how far I'm going to go back, but I could tell you what's on my mind, and listeners can email you and you can pass on to me in terms of helping to assist me in formulating this project. I mean, right. Oftentimes it's said that it was the slave trade takeoff in, say, the 1500s after Columbus that helps to give rise to slavery and white supremacy. You know that the Howard University classicist Frank Snowden wrote this book, Before Color Prejudice, The Ancient View of Blacks. And, you know, I think there's something to that hypothesis, but there are some anomalies. I mean, we know that as early as the 1300s, you have Portuguese going into West Africa enslaving people. This is before Columbus. Then there's this hypothesis about the enslavement of Africans in present-day Iraq in the 9th century, which led to the Zanj slave revolt. End of 872, it lasts about 13 years, beginning about 872 AD. So I have this idea of trying to go further. And then, of course, going back even further to, you know, the era of the Kush and what is now Sudan and Egypt and the conflict between the Kush during the so-called 25th dynasty and the discrimination against darker skinned peoples that are rising out of that part of Africa. So I have this jumble of ideas in my head that I would like to, of course, streamline and convert into a book. But, of course, since I'm not a novelist, I can't make things up. I need sources. I need a thesis. I need a hypothesis, like a light to guide me. So, Norman, I'm sure you give out your email address, right?
Yes, I do. It's norman.o.richmond@gmail.com. I guess you would have to go to Dr. Ben Yohanan and John Hendrick Clark and the brother from Guyana, Van Sertima. Their position is they've always taken the position, I guess, not Van Sertima, but Dr. Ben, and I guess Dr. Ben had a very hard line. I mean, I think he didn't say white folks were born inherently evil, but he may as well have said that. And John Hendrick Clark was somewhere in the middle, but then Van Sertima had a more a softer position than that. But are you going to go to those gentlemen? And also, I don't know what Lorraine Hansberry's father or her uncle, William Hansberry, was. I didn't realize he was a man that was interested in ancient African history, Kemet. I guess you're going to have to consult him as well, right?
Oh, clearly. As I said, I mean, you know, the way you do these projects is that, you know, you need some sort of thesis or hypothesis. You need some sort of outline I just threw out a jumble of ideas. A jumble of ideas does not a book make. I mean, a jumble of ideas is just a jumble of ideas. So that's why I was tossing this out to your audience. Perhaps they could help to streamline it or help me to streamline it so that I could work out this project that would shed light on the roots of what befell Africa and Africans fundamentally, besides the slave trade, which, of course, I've written about, you know, in a number of books. And I guess I've, from my point of view, I think I've sort of exhausted the subject, because this current book basically goes from about 1588 to 1688. But as I said, I mean, I'm still finding it somewhat unsatisfying because, as I said, you know, you can go back to the 1300s, even before 1588, to find the slave trade. So anyway, that's where I am right now.
But anyway, my email address is norman.o.richmond@gmail.com. You email me and I'll get the information to you. Dr. Horn, were you getting ready to say something?
Melinda? Well, I said people could also message the show page on Facebook if people are on Facebook, and it's Diasporic Music.
Oh, good. I look forward to hearing from your highly, exceedingly literate audience.
You have more time, sir, or want to get out of here?
You're the boss. As a matter of fact, okay, tomorrow's boss. National Boss Day.
Uh-huh. Yeah, well, I'm an unpaid boss. But anyway, let's. Can you talk about the Chinese Party Congress,
yes,
Turkey, and the Kurds?
Yeah, please. I mean, this is a very important meeting. Every 5 years, there is a meeting of the Chinese Party Congress. And what I find striking about this Congress is that the theme apparently will be that the Communist Party is going to be asserting more control over private enterprise. Now, you know that the North Atlantic powers, they thought that they found the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow. So 4 decades ago, when U.S. President Richard M. Nixon went to China and helped to initiate this entente with Beijing, that not only led to Beijing deepening its antagonism to the former Soviet Union, but led to this inward foreign direct investment in China that led to this economy. But it's an economy in which the commanding heights have oftentimes been occupied by private enterprise. Well, that's in the process of changing. And as I pointed out on WPFW in Washington the other day, in U.S.-based enterprises and Canadian-based enterprises in China, they're legally mandated to host or to have a Communist Party cells, a Communist Party groups within their enterprises. You don't have that law in the United States, probably not in Canada either. And I think
I don't think so. I think you're absolutely correct.
Yeah, all right. I mean, it's hard for me to see that the Parliament Ottawa mandating that you must have a Communist Party cell in Canadian enterprises. But in any case, this really, it bespeaks the fact that we're going through this subtle shift in the global correlation of forces, with the United States in turmoil as a result of the election of the 45th president, which has split the U.S. ruling class right down the middle. And with Brexit, which has split the British ruling class right down the middle, and I would say has weakened the two pillars of North Atlantic imperialism, and China has taken this moment to then reassert the potency of the Communist Party. So, you know, buckle your seatbelts. The next few months, the next few years are going to be exceedingly interesting.
Did you read that New Africa on China and Africa, that issue? I think it's August, September, July, August issue.
No, tell me about it.
Oh, they're basically taking the position that it's a wait-and-see situation, but they're not. They're basically saying that a lot of the hysteria is coming from Western imperialism. But basically they were saying that, you know, China is not necessarily doing the imperialist thing like the West is trying to promote, that the Chinese are there ripping people off and so on and so forth. And they're basically arguing that, as Duke Ellington once said, that ain't necessarily so. They're not basically saying, they're basically saying that China is wait and see, but they're basically saying that beware of the criticism coming from the imperialists, because you know, the French and the Americans and the British check their record in Africa.
Well, as evidenced by the fact that we have these Africans in North America right now speaking a language developed in Northwest Europe. So we're exhibit A with regard to the tawdry, shameful record of the North Atlantic powers.
Do you want to talk about NAFTA really quickly before we have to go?
Well, this 45th U.S. president is threatening to break up the North American Free Trade Agreement. It's causing quite a bit of consternation in Mexico. Of course, anti-Mexican rhetoric has been his hallmark ever since he decided to run for office in June 2015. And I might say that anti-U.S. imperialist attitudes are deepening and strengthening in Mexico. I also know that Bombardier, the Canadian-based airline manufacturer, has just had a 250% tariff slapped on it by the Yankees at the behest of Boeing, its chief competitor, which is really going to harm the interests, I would say, not only of the Canadian ruling class, perhaps the working class too, and also in Northern Ireland, where it has its major European office. I assume that they're buzzing about that in Canada.
Yes, but we have run out of time, sir.
Okay.
I would like to thank you. I would like to thank Lisa Watson and Melinda Francis, and this is We will see you in the whirlwind. We will be black next Sunday.